It may be the final frontier, but we are doing as much as we can to get back into space, stay in space. You know, we have rovers up on Mars now. There's the space station. A lot of things are happening in the sky, and if you're ignoring it, you're doing so to your peril. Thankfully, one man is not. He is on top of all things space. Rod Pyle is an award-winning author and producer. His latest books are Mars, Making Contact, and Blueprint for a Battle Star, Serious Scientific Explanations Behind Sci-Fi's Greatest Inventions. I've had the pleasure of talking to Rod before, and he joins us again this morning on WGN. Rod, how are you?
I'm good. Good morning. How are you?
Good morning. I'm fantastic. I hear your beard is in full bloom.
Well, it's as good as it gets. I need to put a little dye on it every now and then, because like yours, it's not all the same color, and that bothers me.
Yeah, see, and that it bothered me a little bit, too. I like a more homogeneous coloring to my facial hair.
Okay, what do you use?
I don't use anything now. Now I use a razor.
Oh, okay.
I shaved it. I've tried every sort of facial hair known to man, from the full beard to the goatee to the Fu Manchu, and none of them actually did what I hoped. So now I just, you know, I keep it nice and clean. All right. First of all, let's talk about this new book, because it's almost like you are giving people instructions on how we can build a battle star. Is that correct? So Blueprint for a Battle Star. If I wanted to build one of these in the yard, can I do it?
It would tell you absolutely nothing about that.
That's unfortunate.
Yeah, it's really a survey of all our favorite tech out of sci-fi. Uh-huh. It really focused, although the title has Battlestar in it, one chapter does focus on what it would take to build a Death Star, which turns out to be really, really hard. And there was a group, you may remember, that actually petitioned the U.S. government back in 2012 saying, hey, we've got 25,000 signatures. I think it was petition.org. We had 25,000 signatures, and we really think you guys ought to build a Death Star, to which the government responded, we're not in the business of blowing up planets, and it's harder than you think. As it turns out, it is really hard. So that you can learn.
So it would be really hard, but is it possible?
Well, I think it would take the total output of Earth's steel, if you're going to build it from steel, which, okay, you know, they use nicotronium or something in the movie, but if you're going to use a real metal that we know, it would take 800,000 years worth of Earth's steel output to do it. Many, many gazillions of dollars with a little exponential number up to the right of money, and just the energy to blow up Alderaan would take 12 trillion years to generate. It was only around for 3 trillion years. So it's a big challenge, but, you know, if you want it bad enough, you can probably make it happen.
So what did you find as you were researching the book? I mean, we know a lot of our modern conveniences have come from NASA and research that they've done for the space program. What other things have come from sci-fi that you went, oh, well, this, you know, this was somebody's imagination years ago when it was in a book or movie, and now it's become reality?
Well, there's all that work. You remember Nikola Tesla?
Yes.
The crazy scientist that came up with all these great ideas for force fields and particle beams and all this stuff. He also invented alternating current, which after a kind of a nasty fight with Edison won out over direct current, thank God, or we'd all be glued to our first toaster mistake to this day. And, you know, he came up with stuff that has had – it's been sparse in terms of its practical applications for some of the more way out stuff, although there are people still studying it. But a lot of the things we do use, like everyday electricity, came from his extremely fertile brain. And this guy used to not only come up with invention ideas, but he'd prototype these complex engineering projects in his mind and then just sketch it out. And it was done, and it worked. So he had that kind of brain that we can all just kind of sit back and scratch our heads and go, how does he think like that? And another guy that thinks like that, who I did interview for another book recently, is Buzz Aldrin. This guy, and he's 87 now, I think, so he's not young, but he's been promoting space exploration ever since he got back to Earth. He's one of the few guys from that group of astronauts that never stopped, and he is every week in a new place giving talks, doing lectures, engaging with university students for new projects that he's trying to come up with, and really pushing this Mars agenda. And it's like there's five brilliant minds all running around in there at once, vying for your attention. But he's just a remarkable guy. So that was a thrill.
Now, you mentioned Mars. And Mars, everybody's always been fascinated with Mars. And I think last time I spoke to you was right after the probe had gotten there. The president comes out the other day, and President Obama has been pushing for more space exploration since he got into office. And he came out the other day and he said, basically, listen, I want to get people up to Mars by the 2030s. Again, what's the fascination with Mars for us? And he talked about a partnership between private companies and the government. Is that really going to be the only way, based on funding and everything else, that the U.S. is going to make it to manned travel to Mars?
Excellent question. It doesn't have to be that way, but it probably makes the most sense if it's that way. And I would add the international component. So we've proved with the International Space Station that countries can work together to accomplish these things. It's complicated. It's challenging. But they made it work. And we could probably do it again. That said, you know, Obama has been pushing since he got into office. One of his first acts was to cancel the Constellation Return to the Moon mission, which Bush had set up. And it wasn't a bad idea, but it wasn't being executed well. It wasn't funded sufficiently. It wasn't really going along at the rate that they wanted it to, and it was going to go way over budget. So they said, look, let's stop that, and we'll try this new public-private partnership. But in the mix, Orion got saved, which is the new capsule. It's kind of this oversized Apollo capsule, but much more advanced for deep space exploration. And the Super Booster, the Space Launch System, the SLS, also kind of got cobbled together out of what was left over from Constellation. That's not a direct comparison, but the idea is the same. And you've got, you know, congressional districts that contain the places that build all these things. So that continued going along. And the struggle has been that Obama will pass along a budget for NASA after NASA works up their numbers. And then Congress looks at it and goes, well, okay, we want to change this and we want to change that. And then it goes through the House and so forth. And by the time they're done, it comes back sometimes with even more money, but with all these stipulations on how it should be spent. So, we'll agree on the NASA Mars idea, but we want to do it with this big rocket and this capsule that we're building. We want to put more money over there and take money away from what we're giving to the private companies to develop. And the private companies, which is primarily SpaceX and Boeing, are developing their own spacecraft, their own capsules, and in SpaceX's case, rockets, to take us to the space station so we don't have to keep paying the Russians $83 million per seat, not for the whole ride, but just for one seat in the space capsule to get up there and get back. Yeah,
talk about surge pricing.
Oh, my God. Well, it started at, I think, $52 million, and so it's been going up every year. And the problem is they've got to reserve these seats a couple of years out. So while we're waiting to see how soon, you know, SpaceX has got to go over this rocket problem they had with that explosion a few weeks ago, and the other guys are behind schedule. So while we're waiting to see when exactly they're going to fly, it was going to be 2017, now it looks like 2018 for both of them, we got to figure out how many more $83 million packages we're going to buy from the Russians. So it's challenging. So I think in the end, it'll be a mix of all three entities, NASA, private, and international. But I will add that I had a chance to talk to the guy at NASA. He's number three or number four in the hierarchy, and he's in charge of manned space flight, or human space flight, as it's now referred to. And the plan he laid out over the course of about 40 minutes was this slow, incremental, carefully designed, flexible approach for NASA to basically go it alone using the conventional contractor approach.
Rod, I'm sorry to interrupt. Let's hold on to that. We got to take a quick break for news, and then we'll go into, because I have a lot of questions about Mars and travel and some of the, you know, things that aren't quite working that they're working on. So we'll revisit the slow rollout from NASA. Rod Pyle is my guest. Pylebooks.com is his website where you can read up on all of the Mars making contact and blueprint for a Battlestar Serious scientific explanations behind sci-fi's greatest inventions. We will talk more about space on the other side at 720 WGN. It's Brian Noonan on 720 WGN and for Nick DiGilio. Nick's on vacation for the rest of the week. I am happy to be here, and I am always excited to talk to our guest, Rod Pyle. He is a space expert, an award-winning author and producer. You can go to pylebooks.com to find out about Mars making contact and his newest book, Blueprint for Battlestar Serious scientific explanations behind sci-fi's greatest inventions. You had a book signing tonight at the beginning. You said things went well, Rod?
Yes, they did. I got a good number of people, about 30, I think, and they had lots of questions afterwards, which is always fun as long as I can answer.
There you go. Well, let's go back to what you were talking about right before the news, that we had been talking about the partnership between other nations, the NASA, and private companies to try to get this, what'd you call it, human space travel? Not manned space travel anymore. What'd you call it?
Human space flight.
Human space flight. So we're going to get humans up to Mars. And you started saying that NASA, you would talk to someone in NASA and they were laying out a plan. What was their plan?
The idea is to stay very flexible and try and keep their approach paths open to this. And they're still planning to do an asteroid rendezvous mission with their new rocket and their Orion capsule sometime in the early 2020s is their hope. And the idea is that they grab an asteroid from deeper space, bring it back near the moon, go visit it, work up some technological expertise doing that, kind of getting back in the deeper space flight practice, and then start planning to head off to Mars in the mid-2030s. Now, against this backdrop, you have Elon Musk coming out a couple of weeks ago at this conference in Mexico and saying, that's all fine, but my dream since the beginning has been to colonize Mars, and regardless of what NASA does, I'm going to build this great big-ass rocket that he actually called it BFR for a while, but they have a new name for it.
Interplanetary. I like BFR.
Well, you know what it means, you know?
I do.
And, it paints a very clear picture, but this thing is taller than the Saturn V. It's bigger around the Saturn V, our old Apollo moon rocket, and it's got about four times the thrust, and it's this very kind of brute force direct approach to launch it, refuel it, send it off to Mars, big piece of it lands on Mars, comes home when it's ready, and he wants to start sending these things on a regular basis in the mid-2020s. So it's an audacious, kind of crazy on the surface looking idea, but the engineers that have looked at it have said, you know, I don't see any showstoppers here. It's a matter of cash and engineering expertise and willpower. And man, has that guy got willpower.
Yes, he does. Now, you mentioned the space station before and how expensive it is for us to rent seats to get up there. The space station's important for a number of reasons on this whole Mars thing, because we've got to test out a lot of different technology up there. Because one of the things I was reading about is the life support systems. They reported that they life support systems that theoretically worked for years when they were down here on Earth, once they got them up in space, they were only working for about a week. So we've got, what can we do to increase our time on that space station where we can test out some of this stuff that we will eventually need to get people up to Mars and then safely back?
Well, part of it is how long you keep the station. There's been various dates planned, 2020, 2024, as to when it deorbits. And the older it gets, the more time that the astronauts up there have to spend keeping everything running and repairing things and doing EVAs outside to replace malfunctioning units and so forth. So the more time, but this is a balance because you've also got to stop spending money on that so you can start spending money on your Mars rocket, right?
Mm-hmm.
So it's this balance of where you put your time and resources. What they're hoping to do is keep it till at least 2024, maybe longer, although the Russians have said, hey, we're going to build another station and we're taking our modules from your space station and we're going to take them over to our other ones so you figure something out. So probably 2024, 2025. It'll be decommissioned and deorbited in pieces. So while it's there, they want to do as much medical fact-finding as they can, and they are making good progress at finding ways to mitigate the effects of zero gravity on people's bodies. But it's a lot harder than we ever thought. You know, back in the 50s and 60s, it's like, hey, you put a guy in a can, you send him out into space, he does his things, he floats around for a while, everything's fine, he comes back and he's healthy. And we're finding that that's not necessarily the case.
Right.
You know, it affects their cardiovascular system, apparently. Their eyes get elongated and have more trouble focusing properly. Sometimes that's a permanent change. They lose bone density that you can get back. And the big bugaboo is radiation, the stuff that radiation does. I mean, we're basically sacks of meat and water. Mm-hmm. And we don't like being in space. We like being on Earth.
Yeah.
So you spend too much time out there with all these high energy particles from the sun and from beyond the solar system banging through your body. And it can do a lot of damage right down at the DNA level. So that's something they're working on mitigating. They use exercise, they use a certain amount of shielding, at least they're experimenting with that. And they're actually finding that there are drugs that help control some of these factors. So it may be a combination of pharmaceuticals and technological innovation that makes this all work.
Well, now reports came out just the other day that are saying, yeah, there's so much radiation as they estimate a trip to Mars definitely enough to cause cancer. And now studies are showing that brain damage, you know, irreparable brain damage could be caused by all that radiation.
Yeah, and that's kind of a new one. And one of the guys, I was at a conference recently, an aerospace conference recently, where there was a gentleman who was an astronaut and an MD who was talking about this for quite a while. And he said, you know, there's things we're just, we've been going to space for 50 years.
Yeah.
There's things we're just finding that we just missed before. And the Russians have actually had people in orbit, single astronauts, cosmonauts in their case, longer than we have. But either the way they were sharing the data or the way the data came in or the way they were record keeping didn't give anybody good enough clues to really pick this up. So they're finding, and this is one of the things they're finding, that radiation's just much more damaging than we thought, even when you're inside a metal cylinder. And there's problems with that. When these certain particles hit the hull of the spacecraft, it actually is slowed down, but then three or four particles are spawned by the impact, and those go hurtling through the inside of the spaceship. So that's another problem. So this thing you're talking about, apparently it damages neurons in the brain, it causes inflammation over time, and this is all done, by the way, experimenting with mice. This is not something they really looked at in the astronauts. This is exposing mice to that environment over time, but it takes a long time to get Mars and back. You're looking at a year plus if they do it the way they've been talking about doing it. So if people are exposed the same way that these mice are, the fear is that they'll start having coordination problems, depression, forgetfulness, and all these other things, kind of like dementia almost, and that it can be a real problem on a mission. So they've got to figure out a way to deal with that. Drugs may be part of it, but it's also, they're going to have to figure out a way to shield these guys.
Now, this may seem silly, but would it make sense to try to put people on the moon to live there, stay there for a while to kind of work out some of the technology and that kind of thing, and then shoot for Mars after that? Or is the atmosphere so different between the moon and Mars that it wouldn't make that much of a difference?
No, and you've walked right into the big fight.
That's what I like to do, Rod. I come in swinging. Let's go. Let's go to the moon.
And you did it wonderfully.
Thanks for
setting that up.
Sure.
We've been in orbit now for 30-plus years. You know, we haven't been back to the moon since the 70s. We haven't left the cocoon of Earth and the magnetosphere, which protects us from some of the radiation particles and so forth. So there's a lot of people, both in NASA and outside, academics, former astronauts, saying, look, let's just get the moon thing down again. Let's spend time working there, living there, understand more about this radiation problem. If we have issues, you're 2 or 3 days from home instead of 3 to 6 months from home.
Yeah.
And we can reach the people and they're going to be okay. So NASA still, you know, that's in that plan, but they're talking mainly about, okay, let's set up something in orbit around the moon. There's no need to spend all this time and effort to get down the surface because we've kind of done that. Well, that's kind of true, but, you know, we were there as visitors.
Yeah, we just stopped over. We touched down, not to diminish it, but we landed, we jumped out, planted a flag, unless you believe it was in a soundstage somewhere, which I do not. But then we took off. We didn't hang around and, like, do a lot of stuff.
Yeah, these were expeditions that were operating right at the cutting edge of the technology of the 1960s. So the idea is go back and really learn how to work there. And there's also a lot of thinking along the lines of there's resources there. Every time we fly a rocket, we got to haul all the fuel up from Earth into orbit and then to go beyond. And that takes a lot of energy and a lot of money. If you can find the stuff you need to make fuel on the moon, which we're pretty certain is there, there appears to be big chunks of ice on the poles. Well, from water ice, you can get hydrogen and oxygen.
Right.
That's fuel that the shuttle used. So that's a perfect thing to be able to move on from there. So that's another reason to go there.
Turn it into a gas station.
Well, exactly. And asteroids, you can do the same thing when they're passing by. And there's a bunch of companies in the U.S. looking at this to do it robotically. But the Europeans are talking about establishing a lunar village, a human-occupied lunar village there, to look at some of these factors and get more experience and contribute to this big overall program of moving humanity off the planet into other worlds. So these are all exciting developments. It just comes down to the old no bucks, no buck Rogers.
Right.
We got to decide if we're going to get serious or not.
Are other countries willing, and is NASA willing to cooperate with other countries? Because this does seem like a global thing, more than just a United States thing and a NASA thing. It does seem like it's going to take all the brains from all these countries to contribute to this, to finally get this done.
Yeah, I think they're looking at that very seriously. And each group of spacefaring countries at this point brings their strengths. Obviously, the Soviet Union and now Russia have been doing this since we have, actually a little earlier. So they're very good at certain things. They're good at space stations. They're good at building rockets, reliable rocket engines and spacecraft. We have more expertise in the bleeding edge of high tech and navigation and so forth. The European Space Agency has been flying rockets for a number of decades, and they're getting very good at it, and they have their strengths. And then you've got this wild card with the Chinese. They've been actually working on their space program since the late 50s, early 60s, but it went very slowly. Now they're getting serious. They've had taikonauts, which is what they call their astronauts, in orbit a number of times. They just put up their second space station. It's small, but it works very well, and it's brand new tech. So they're learning how to do this. They intend to put humans on the moon by the mid-2020s. Mars is a little foggier. They said maybe 2040, but you know, let's get this down first.
Yeah.
So they're moving ahead very aggressively, but we've got a problem, which is NASA isn't allowed to work with the Chinese because of international trade restrictions. So that's got to be figured out before this can move ahead.
Well, that makes sense. We got to take a break, but I need to talk to you about NASA, why they are setting fires in space. And also, I hear you have dual citizenship now, which is very exciting.
Yes, just got it, and it wasn't hard.
All right, so we will talk about all of that. Rod Pyle is my guest. Go to pylebooks.com to read up on all the wonderful things that Rod has done. We will talk more about space on the other side. It's WGN. A few more minutes with Rod Pyle. We're talking about space on WGN. And as it always is, Rod, I look at the clock and I go, man, we got a lot to talk about in only a few more minutes. So let's start real quick. Why is NASA setting fire in space? What's going on?
Well, they want to know how it works, because fire behaves differently in a zero-gravity environment than it does on an environment like the surface of Earth, where we have gravity. So there's been this is the second major experiment. It's a program called SAFFIRE. And what they do is they have these, you know, they have these cargo rockets that go up and deliver cargo to the space station with these robotic vehicles.
Mm-hmm.
SpaceX does it, and this other company has a vehicle called the Antares that they do it with. But when SpaceX does a supply run, they bring the capsule back, and it lands under parachutes, and it brings back experiments and other materials that they want to actually bring back. The other company, Orbital ATK, just sends the delivery capsule back to Earth in a reentry, and it burns up. It doesn't have a heat shield, and it's designed to do that.
Okay.
So their idea was, as long as these things are being tossed away anyhow, let's do some experiments in them that would be valuable. So you can imagine you're headed off to Mars. You've been in space for 2 months. You're really far away from Earth. You can't turn around and go back. You have to loop around Mars at least. So it's many months to get back. And a fire breaks out. You got smoke. You got damage. How are these flames going to propagate? How do you best put it out and so forth? So these experiments are designed to deliberately ignite a fire on a pallet of cloth and various materials. This new one they're doing will include plastics and other materials. And they're going to see how the flames burn, how they spread, what rate they spread, what directions they go. And as it turns out, it looks like they just kind of follow the airflow, and they spread pretty slowly. Okay. And they propagate almost in a sphere. So it's really fascinating. Instead of the heat convection that you get, like when you see a candle burning, going up away from the force of gravity, these things propagate in a sphere, and they move very slowly. So the good news is they're a little easier to control. The not-so-good news is there's still a lot more to learn, especially about how to extinguish these things quickly.
Ah, well, that's good experiments then. All right, let's get to the important thing, because soon we'll all be able to be citizens of space. You are now a citizen of Asgardia, and I hear that,
yes,
and I think
sir.
Of Thor, the Norse god of thunder. But I know you are not a Norse god of thunder, but you are still a citizen of Asgardia, the first nation state in space. As of just a few minutes ago, 27,333 people also citizens of Asgardia. What is this all about, Rod?
The idea is I'm taking a calling. I've only known about this for a few days because they set out this embargoed press release just recently. But the idea is it's a nation in a can. Basically, this nationality, and I hope I'm coining that phrase, this nationality will exist in the orbited object, so in this satellite.
Okay.
And the reason they're doing this is, if you're a country on Earth, especially a small country, there's a lot of hoops to jump through to start flying stuff into orbit. You've got to deal with all kinds of legal regulations. Basically, if you launch a rocket and fly it, you're liable for what happens. So that's part of it. There's a thing called the Outer Space Treaty that was put together in the 60s. We signed it. Russia signed it. Now 102 other nations have signed it. And it regulates, you know, you can't have weapons in space. You can't claim territory. You can't do this. You can't do that. Well, we're not sure if Asgardia is going to sign on with that. They probably will eventually. But their idea is if they claim nationhood in orbit, they can pretty much do whatever they want, and they can invite smaller countries to come along and work with them and achieve things that they might not be able to do from Earth. So while citizenship, it's the easiest citizenship I've ever gotten, for sure, because it's basically name, email, address, and I am over 18. So that's not too bad. It's kind of like signing up for, you know, Netflix or something. But it's an interesting idea. And why they're doing this, I think why they make it so simple is they claim if they can reach 100,000 people, which they've got a quarter of the way to just today, they can apply for state status and get recognition from the UN and that kind of thing.
Let me ask you this, because as I was reading about this, one, I am also a citizen of Asgardia, which is very exciting. We'll have to have some sort of get together. I didn't realize there was an outer space treaty. I read that and thought, boy, that's something, sounds like something right out of Star Trek. There is a real outer space treaty. What's that all about?
The idea was, you know, during the space race, we were doing that because we had this arch enemy in the Soviet Union. And at one point, people woke up and said, you know, we could put weapons up there. I mean, we can just drop nuclear bombs from orbit. How sweet will that be? That'll take care of things quickly. So before that thinking got out of control, cooler minds prevailed and got together and said, let's put the brakes on this and have an agreement. So while you can have conventional weapons like a pistol or a mortar or bazooka in space, you can't have weapons of mass destruction. You can't develop them. You're not supposed to test them. There's been some things that could conceivably be violations, but they haven't been serious. And the important thing is you can't go to the moon and say, okay, I'm here. This is mine. It's like Antarctica. It belongs to everybody. So you just have to agree with that.
Okay. And so that's Asgardia is going to be under that treaty, so we can't claim anything in our out of our little satellite country.
I mean, they have to become recognized as a nation before they could sign the treaty. But a dear friend of mine, Susan Holden Martin, brought up a very interesting point, which I hadn't thought of. She's a trained attorney, and she thinks like that. And she said, you know, if you become a citizen of that country, do you share liability for something that goes wrong? And I thought, oh
my.
That's so great. So, hey, you and I might see, we might meet in court. Who knows?
Well, listen, if somebody from Asgardia wants to sue me or, you know, another country wants to sue me because my nation is infringing on their space, their space in space, let them come at me.
Yeah.
Real quick, before I let you go, Rod, there's a lovely conspiracy theory that I'm always a fan of those. There is speculation that the SpaceX explosion may have been sabotage.
Yeah, this was very interesting. SpaceX had put out a call to anybody that had video footage of that event to please let them see it so that they could try and track down what happened, because it's been a real mystery for them. One of the tapes showed a little flash and a shadowy movement on top of the building about a mile away from their launch pad, which their competitor, United Launch Alliance, owns. So they apparently sent a representative over to knock on the door and say, hey, I'd like to see your roof. And ULA said, go away. We're not going to do that.
Yep.
But they did eventually let somebody from the Air Force go up who looked around and said, nothing there. Now, I don't think SpaceX really took this seriously. And they're taking everything seriously, but they weren't worked up about it. They said, look, we just got to check everything. But when you think about it, you know, these guys are competitors. There's a lot of money at stake here. But there's other things. If you want to grow the conspiracy, you know, it was an Israeli satellite on an arch competitor's rocket. And I haven't heard anybody mention the Russians yet. Think of how much money they're going to lose if SpaceX is successful in taking away these $83 million seats. I'm not saying I think any of that's true. I'm just saying those are things you can add in the mix. However, just in the last couple of days, SpaceX did announce that they think they have the culprit, and it's a technological problem in the top of that second stage. So I think this thing has kind of gone away. But it was fun while it lasted.
Yeah, that's not as sexy as a conspiracy that now may or may not include the Russians.
Yeah.
I'm going to keep that part going. Listen, Rod, it is always a pleasure to talk to you. Very informative and very interesting, because you make even a guy like me understand the stuff that's happening. So we appreciate that. Everybody needs to go to pilebooks.com and pick up Mars Making Contact and Blueprint for a Battlestar Serious Scientific Explanations Behind Sci-Fi's Greatest Inventions. Always a pleasure. Keep that beard nice and colorful.
sensational. You take care of yours, too. Take care.
Take care, Rod. That's Rod Pyle. It is always fun talking space with Rod. All right, let's do this, and then it's news time on WGN.